came to me, I might have put them in upside down every time.
All right, I think we're on side four now, and did you get into any experimental work then during this period in the Society of Fellows?
I'm trying to remember that I did either that year or the next year. I tried to set up a long path near infrared spectrometer setup, and for basement I had a long pipe about 100 feet long, and I had some spectrometer like Kistiakowski, I'm sure. When I was here, I had two people who were very, very helpful to me. One was Kistiakowski, and I did try some experimental work, which was a failure. And the other was Van Vleck, who was most helpful on mechanical regime. Yeah, I tried to do the far infrared work. I can't remember whether it was that year, the first year when I was in the faculty, which was the following year.
Was there any experimental or infrared work going on here then?
No, there wasn't. Only spectroscopy, I guess, was George was doing some fluorescence and visible spectroscopy.
Let's see, you were in the Society of Fellows for 3 years, or?
I only stayed 2 years. It was a 3-year appointment. But they offered me a job. See, the second year in the Society, our book had come out, and I gave a lecture course from it while I was in the Society.
Mm-hmm.
And then the department offered me an assistant professorship, and I resigned the Society and took the assistant professorship.
Okay. And you began teaching physical chemistry then, or what?
Right away, yes. I gave that quantum mechanics course before I was appointed to the faculty. Then, when I was in the first year as a faculty member, I took over the physical chemistry course from my predecessor, who didn't get promoted. And I had about 100 students in that course.
What was the general content of the physical chemistry you'd taught then?
Thermodynamics was the center of my emphasis.
Did you develop your own notes or use someone's text?
I pretty much developed my own notes, though I had a text, but there were, of course, many texts available, and I wasn't ever very happy with any of the texts. I did recommend one.
I believe Judd Wells was your first graduate student?
Judd Wells was my first graduate student. Jack Howard was in a special category. He was not a graduate student of mine, because I was in the Society of Fellows initially at the time. We worked together. He certainly was, as part of his thesis, his collaborative work we had together. The Wells came along as the first real graduate student.
And you built an infrared spectrometer at that time?
Well,
went on?
What happened there was that George Kistiakowski gave me a student, I mean an assistant, a postdoctoral fellow. He happens to have ended up for retirement as the head of the Shell Development Company, but at that time he was Harold Shinovitz.
Oh, yes.
And he came to meet with me, George paid for him, and he became postdoctoral with me. And it really was Shinovitz, largely. We worked together on it, but he was crucial to build a semi-automatic infrared spectrometer. It was the queerest thing you ever saw.
Yeah, would you describe it? I've heard tales about it and never saw it.
Well, we had one machine piece built for us, but then there was a typewriter carriage and some ratchets, and there was a motor-driven thing that turned a couple of cranks around. The cranks had strings on, and various things happened. First of all, there were two cells, one on top of the other, and they moved up and down in this mechanical contrivance when he was running. And they'd move up and put the blank cell in, and move down and put the fill cell in the path. And then there were strings that pulled the typewriter cage so that the photographic papers moved a notch at a time. And the machinery moved the prism, rotated the prism by a definite amount each cycle, you see. So this thing was, you started going and it ran itself. The things went on.
Oops.
They worked on strings and it developed, put a bar, it put the blank and the zero and so on this photographic paper. So you had to remeasure, you had to measure the photographic paper afterwards. You could do so at your leisure. And we also had interchangeable prisms, so we had a little tiny capacity in bromide prism for going a little further into the infrared than you could do with rock salt.
The sodium chloride with the regular prism.
Sodium chloride.
How long would it take to run a spectrum?
Well, about a week.
That's right.
I mean, something you could do on an early Perkin-Elmer, half an hour, I guess. It takes about 5 days, 4 or 5 days.
What was the source?
Globar.
Uh-huh. And it stayed stable that long?
We had zeros every cycle.
We had a couple of zeros
and a blank. Mm-hmm. No, things could, on a bad day, they drift all over the place. But it's largely a question of temperature drifts, I think. We had optical amplifier on the thermocouple system. The galvanometer was from the thermocouple, directly to the thermocouple. Galvanometer was then amplified by a second galvanometer. Question of a grid, slots, and two brass plate, and as the light from the prism from the galvanometer swung across this thing, you got light going through the slots and not going through the slots anyway. And you could get enormous amplification up to Brownian motion, no problem at all. So you were stuck by the noise and the bouncing around and the drifts limited the sensitivity.
This was mounted on in the basement or on a...
There's a big pier still there. Well, no, they actually ripped it out. There's a pier in the sub-basement. It's in a box, because otherwise if water comes in, groundwater comes in. So there's a box up to the first floor. And then a concrete pier inside this, not on the first floor, but the basement floor, mm-hmm. from the sub-basement. And we sat on that pier and did our best on the noise and vibration.
Any parts of this spectrometer still in existence?
I don't think so. I'm afraid not.
Was that an advance in the state of the art at the time, or?
I would say it was, yes. Michigan, which was the place, they were operated by a graduate student writing down the reflections of the galvanometer, peak, zero, blank, and write it in the notebook. Because we had to measure just exactly those same quantities out of the photographic paper.
Yes.
But with our own speed.
So when did the first commercial infrared spectrometers arrive?
Pretty early.
This department got
one of the first one from not Perkin-Elmer.
Baird. Was it Baird or was
Baird? This department got that. We had nothing to do with other organic chemistry. So that was certainly a number of years later then. I don't know when that was. Perkin-Elmer, I do know, was during the war. There are stories about that.
Yes. You never did really get much into the experimental side of infrared and vibrational spectroscopy. Did you?
Well,
beyond,
no.
Let's see, the intensity measurements with Judd Wells.
Intensity measurements with Judd Wells, and people still use that method. It's not a good method, but that's what they have, I guess. It's difficult to get the results with it, but it is. And that's an example of what I meant by sometimes the idea is to get out to execute them. Send it that well.
Let me jump ahead or jump out momentarily because somewhere along here I should really ask you what you feel your most significant contributions were in
well the I think one of them that has had a lot of effect, and you know, all these things are very simple really when you look at them. And I wish I could give you a sophisticated answer to my discovery of this or that. It's startling.
You sound like Peter Debye explaining to us how simple his theories of Palmer physics were and not being believed. continue.
This work with Howard on the Hamiltonian has really been used a great deal of in the basis. When you think about it, it's pretty obvious. But that has, and then nowadays, of course, there are modern versions which are much more sophisticated. But people still mostly use this idea model. Now, on the group theory, I think I had an influence by the fact that I didn't discover it. That's how the salesman for the technique. I certainly have a great deal of pleasure applying it myself to a large number of molecules. This spectrometer is nothing. I mean, that was an ephemeral there. Infrared spectrometer. We did a number of molecules on it. Some good people like Bryce Crawford and Jack Bennett did molecules working with me. I had a marvelous group my first year as an assistant professor. Those people on there really were good.
Let's see, was Bryce Crawford a postdoctoral?
Yes, he got the one we had in those days. And he'd been working with Paul Cross as a graduate student, sent him to me. The paper for which has had the most demand, reprints and so on, sort of same story, the FG method for molecular vibrations. And
could you describe that briefly?
Well, it's really, again, something well known to mathematicians. I remember we know that we have, am I spoiling this again?
I don't think it's you. I think I'm, no, I'm all right. It seemed to be cutting out when I would speak. We're all right now, thank you.
Well, let me get this where I was.
The FG matrix.
The F, of course, is the force constant matrix. Quadratic force field. G is a way of expressing the kinetic energy. And I repeat that I think this is very well known in mathematicians, applied mathematicians and so on. But it was not well known in this game, in this application. And I wrote a paper, first paper on it, and It got, abstracted in chemical abstracts as follows. M-A-T-H, period. That is the entire abstract. And I wasn't the only one to suffer from that, because they just had nobody to do theoretical papers, and so many of the abstracts were like that. But later on, a few years ago, there's a journal that, I forget which one it is, that has little articles every month on highly quoted papers. Somebody asked me to write up about the FG method. It's been quoted so much, so often. I wrote what I said, but it didn't get quite that kind of play when it came out. But that is generally, I'd say, the most quoted paper, and of course partly because in the book on molecular vibrations. And now going along, what have I done?
Well, okay, the microwave spectroscopy, of course.
Yes.
Was,
See, I worked on vibrational spectra for a while, and then the war came along, and I worked on a little bit longer, but not much, mainly writing Elton Jackie's to get the book out. And then I moved almost immediately after the war to microwave spectroscopy, because it had been done during the war by MIT radiation lab people. Now, the stark effect spectrometer was, again, just like my tungsten platinum invention, product of ignorance. And I'm a great believer in products of ignorance. I never do anything. But it was really so, because it seemed perfectly obvious to do this, modulate this thing with this field. It is perfectly obvious. I think a dozen people would have come on it a week later. But I didn't know that why. I didn't understand anything about it. And I didn't know, for example, that the main source of noise was 1/F noise. And that's what the spark effect does. It pushes you up in frequency.
Yes.
That's 1/F noise. I didn't know about that. It just seemed an obvious thing to try, and I had the cues put together with the machinery and tried it. And the first time he turned that on, it was just great. It was a great feeling. I was there with him. Put ammonia in the system. Now, ammonia is the only molecule really we could do before. Very long path. So, basically infinite on the F3 line. That was a very exciting moment when the first attempt to start. I will boast a little bit that we made this thing available to people. Anybody want to come and see me, like came and see me. Just coming out of the war, everybody was so secret in those days because they don't even train to be secret. And we tried to fight that, and did. The people went and built them immediately, their own assistant to do. And of course, other people thought of it, had thought of it at the same time. They saw it at Pittsburgh, Westinghouse. Actually went to their patent department with a patent, and we applied for a patent, but we waited until the last minute, in fact, before we applied. And they had preceded us by nearly a year in applying, but we got the patent in the end because we had reduced it to practice. They never made one.
Did you ever get anything out of that patent?
I think a few $1,000 altogether. It was sold, we gave it to the Search Corporation eventually, arranged for them to take it over. And they got licensed, they sold licenses to the package. and to another place. But, of course, there was an exemption for government use, and I think Hewlett-Packard spectrometer was sold almost exclusively to government agencies at first. And I think by the time they got around to having anything that had any royalties, that would run out. Well, it's not a financial demand.
Microwave spectroscopy never really took off in the way that NMR did, or or infrared.
I've often wondered if that isn't partly my fault, to be honest. Because, you know, I sort of, you fellows as students, I had a real monopoly situation. But if you look at the people who did microwave spectroscopy, so many of them had been here, but I did have a particularly special position. And that's not good.
Well, it was tough competition, though. You had Charlie Towns some work going on at MIT. I forget who was there.
The GE?
At MIT.
Yes, Dennis Strandberg was.
Yes, yeah.
There's no doubt. You see, first it was physicists. And in this kind of business, physicists are a lot smarter than chemists, let's face it. Except they don't, you see, they know too much sometimes, Charlie Towns, because he knew you had to use a superheterodyne type, you know, beating the frequency down. That's not so, as we showed, but we showed it out of ignorance. Yes, I don't want to claim that, I mean, Charlie Towns is number one in this game, was. Strandberg is a very capable guy, and there are many others who are in the business, but they didn't go into doing polyatomic molecules, I can assure you, when we started with them. They were doing diatomics, if possible, or normal.
Oh, that's right.
Physical phenomena, and so on.
You pushed into the internal rotational problem.
In fact, I
came cropper on nitromethane. I couldn't solve that one. Gwynn's group beat me on that one.
Yeah, that was too bad. Well, I would say I was pushed into the internal rotation, because I'd been involved with George earlier with a lot of the vibrational molecules we studied. Involved in terms of the methane, the ethane problem. The work of several papers on that, for example, theory of the statistical weights and so on. So I was very interested in internal rotation in an earlier state. The main possibility was microwave. Business. There, I must say, you fellows pushed me into that pretty hard.
I thought you pushed us.
Well, in part of both ways, but Trilb and of course Hirschbach later, a little bit later, and other people who worked in the beginning there. I wasn't quite prepared to push it as far as, for example, Trilb insisted on doing. Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd sort of run out of rigid rotors by that,
the
mid-50s.
That's still not run out of, except what the interest has. Well, the interpretation was an important.
Let me jump ahead to, you wrote one very good paper on group theory application to NMR spectra of symmetrical molecules. And then you did nothing more in NMR, as far as I can call.
Well, you know, you said earlier that microwave hasn't played the role that NMR has. Of course, it's nowhere near playing the role that NMR has. Now, there's certain obvious reasons for that. First, the liquid state. But, yeah. I don't know, because it's a little hard to say what I should have done, but I think we could have done a lot better.
I was never able to sell gas phase microwave spectroscopy and DuPont. I don't think anybody had much success in industry. It's almost the same as with electron diffraction, gas phase electron diffraction.
First, the limitation to gas phase is a very extreme limitation. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the dipole moment requirement is somewhat of a limitation. And it doesn't have the universal applicability that NMR has, nowhere near. It's a marvelous tool. I think it's a marvelous tool, and I still love it, like, frankly. I wish I could go on and do more of it. But
in your later career, you got into reaction kinetics via double resonance experiments?
Well, we did a couple of some relaxation time. But there we were really scooped by Oka, Takeshi Oka.
Mm-hmm.
He did a much better job than we did. He was to it. Did a lot of molecules. That was a fairly disappointing performance.
I wanted to ask about the book Introduction to Scientific Research. What prompted you to write that?
Well, I guess my wartime experience, where we did some goofing on watching the news of the war situation. I won't go into the details of that, but that's the use of statistics. We did a mistake in one of our projects. And it's because of my ignorance of statistics. And I said, oh, I just got to learn something about this.
I did quite a bit of reading on operations research, and I can't remember who. I think there was a book titled Operations Research that
Kimball wrote something.
Probably was Kimball's book, but your book was basically in part
it was that sort of
based on that sort of.
I don't think that I'm still a fellow member of the Operations Research Society of America. I don't know why I pay my 15 a year because I haven't done anything since wartime with it. But,
you wrote that when you were at Oxford?
I had a fortunate sabbatical at the right moment after the war, 2950. And I had collected a bunch of ideas on cards. I'd carry them in my pocket and I'd pull out an index card, ask somebody, well, what's your favorite scientific joke, or what do you think about scientific method? What's the special thing that you like? And it's got, everybody has a special thing that they believe in, a special trick or a special theorem or something. So I collected a lot of these cards. I found them the other day, this whole batch of them. And those were the basis for the book, which I put together in Oxford, and pretty well did it that year. And I had a lot of fun writing that book. Really enjoyed it.